guys. What's going on? Welcome.
Hey.
Hey.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Wherever you may be. We are spread across the world on many different, one continent, apparently, but...
Three time zones.
Incredible going on. We are glad to have you here, folks. This is the To the Unknown Pod. For those of you who don't know, I would imagine if you're a Christian, if you're listening to this, you're probably a Christian. Maybe not a bulletproof assumption, but there's a good chance. If you're wondering where in the world, why To the Unknown Pod, there is a passage in the book of Acts, chapter 17, where the Apostle Paul was there and he's talking to a bunch of Greeks. And he sees this, there's like this statue that says it's like it's designed to be talking about this unknown God. Greeks worship all these kind of gods, including even gods who they didn't know about. So this was this one called the unknown God. And so we thought we'd be silly and name name the pod to the unknown pod. So that's what we're doing.
This is the first time I've heard that explanation. I like it.
Oh, yeah. Well. Where have you been, Matt? Anyhow, we are glad to have you here, everybody. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the director of TGFB Media. We exist to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere.
Hey, I'm Oshawa Hawthorne. I'm the founder and director of Brilliance Labs, a startup incubator for Kingdom Projects.
I'm Ryan Finley, founder of Tracker, a software company. We build publishing software. I'm a dad, father of six, and I've been married to my wife for 20 years.
Whoop, whoop.
Wow. Yeah. My name is Matt. I'm in Hawaii, pastor, and as it says on the screen, entrepreneur, but I'm just someone who's always interested in doing different things.
And we are here. If you're wondering what you wandered into, this basically podcast, here's what we do. We come in here because all week long, we're on Twitter. We find tweets that are particularly helpful for us, whether it's as fathers or husbands or just men or people or any one of a number of other things. And we find that we just think, you know what? I wish other people could see this and I wish I could talk about it. And so we just decided, you know what? We're going to make a podcast where we just do that. So that's what we're going to do. Throughout the majority of the podcast, we're going to, be straight-laced. We're going to talk about, serious, important things. And then near the end, we're gonna get a little crazy, okay? We're gonna find some hot memes, some potentially humorous things that we found that we liked. So you can look forward to that or skip ahead to that. Hopefully you won't skip ahead. We can get to that later. But Oshawa is gonna be our garçon, our waiter, if you will, serving up the tweets in question. So Oshawa, why don't you take the lead for us?
Sure. Okay. This is the first one up from Old Hollow Tree.
Whose is this?
Yeah, who wants to chat about this one?
Ryan can introduce it.
Yeah, I can start. I stole this one from Matt.
Keep your eyes on your own paper there, Ryan. Thanks.
Matt found this last week after we talked about the previous week, and it's just so gold. I think it's just, I'll just start off as someone who moved far away. This is from Old Hollow Tree on Twitter. Looks like a really, I actually just followed Old Hollow Tree, so looks like a really cool account. But as someone who moved far away from my parents and had children in my mid-30s, I'd say if you're able to marry young, have children, live on or close to the family estate, do so. Too many challenges arise if you are far from aging family with children. And yeah, dude, there's just so much wisdom in this. And I would say, especially if you're close with your family, because as your parents get older, I'm sitting where I am today because our family packed our bags and moved back to my hometown to help take care of my dad as he was going through Alzheimer's. And so, super... we had an awesome time in Hawaii, but also I do have some regrets because those, like, some of the last really good years that my dad had, like, we weren't around. So it was kind of reduced to seeing him a couple times a year. That's tough. But anyways, I it's definitely impacted my long-term view of like how to try to set up a kind of a home base for, you know, for our kids, and just working as hard as I can to enable them to stay near each other, stay close to my wife and I, and if they want to. And and kind of thinking about like engineering life in reverse, because a lot of times people are like, oh, that'd be cool, but then you don't actually put in the time and work it takes to potentially pull it off. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of entrepreneurial stuff with our, especially our older three boys, just to enable them to stay here and flourish. And
I mean, I feel like we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but it's just so countercultural, right? Because like so much of the cultural expectation is you have kids who can't wait to get away from you when they turn 18. They want to go to school. They go, you know, go do their Rumma Springa. You just go sow their wild oats and, you know, go nuts. And then they end up wasting probably the first three years of college. They're just kind of partying, doing whatever. And then they might get serious near that, you know, last year and a half when really you have to kind of lock in. And then you just want to move away, and you think about yourself as an atomistic individual, rather than as part of an organic part of something bigger. And so, yeah, I just think there's so many practical reasons, that makes sense to be connected and to stay close to parents, if you can. Again, we mentioned this, I think, at the end of the last episode, but you know, there's obviously people who are going to push back and just say, hey, well, what about Abraham? Abraham, you know, went out not knowing where he was going. And, you know, obviously that was God's plan. It's like, yeah, 100%. But the exceptions prove rules.
Yeah.
Like,
Abraham brought a couple hundred people with you.
Well, yeah, exactly. Then again, a lot of these things, there's a lot of assumptions that don't bear themselves out. But even if you do at face value, it is true he left his family. Like that, the fact that, you know, description is not prescription. This is not how everyone's case. The vast majority of Christians in the history of the universe, history of the world, did not, you know, were not missionaries, and that was not God's expectation for them. So, you know, that is true of people. That is a good and right calling. But it is a temporal deviation from a norm. That God has designed to be in place.
I think that would be the controversial part. What you just said, Jordan, is that there's a norm, there's a template. Is I think the words I used last podcast, and if you guys want to check it out, if you're listening, it was kind of middle endish of the podcast last week. That might be the controversial part. But what I found interesting is we had this conversation, and then the same week, it pops up on this feed. I don't believe the guy heard our podcast, Overall Tree, but, and I
Dabs are listening to you, Matt.
Yeah. But I do. And I don't know that I've never seen any evidence that he's a Christian. By conviction, there goes my automatic air conditioner.
I'm still moving on here. Nice. One of the things I'll push back on with, I won't apologize for pushing back against our culture, because I've actually heard a lot of people in the past obviously this is completely counterculture to the way our culture operates. Our culture is just like, you know, success is sending your kids far away and then, you know, getting their dream job and, you know, making a lot of money. And so wanting your kids to stay has like literally been this thing where like you're basically accused of being selfish and like all these things. And it's like, it's actually not that at all. Like success in life isn't your kids making a lot of money in another city. It's like them doing really well as a family, as a couple, like as mothers, fathers, you know, being a part of a really good church, just flourishing in all the other areas. And, anyway, so if there's parents out there that are feeling guilty, like don't apologize for it.
Just 2 days ago, on Sunday afternoon after church, I drove down and met with a family who the Island Boys know them. and she has ALS. The mom has ALS. So she's in her last even potential weeks, months, like that. She's at home and her son's taking care of her. She's in the bed. She can't move around by herself. She's even in the home with her ex-husband, who is graciously like, yes, she can come to the house. And I brought communion for her and went over. I baptized her maybe 14 years ago, estimate. And so for me, it was a special experience. And I think it speaks to this, you know. And I even talked about, okay, what happens if they go into stage 3, you know, I don't remember the numbers, whatever it is, the last stage of hospice. I said, so are you going to be able to stay here? Or are they going to try to take you to a hospice home? And it was like, no, she's staying there. When it's time to go to that stage 3, there's just going to be more visits. And I brought up an article I read years ago about Billy Graham. You know, you could think about who's reached more people than Billy Graham in terms of evangelism. Everyone in their old age says, I wish I would have done less things and spent more time with family. And he did too.
Mm.
And what a sad situation, but what a beautiful picture that she's there in the living room with her hospital bed being taken care of by her family at the end. And so just to kind of emphasize two things I want to emphasize. Number one, if it sounds hard to you, selfish or whatever, just let this challenge embed in your mind, take the medicine. It's a part of a comprehensive view of how does God see things, and allow your grip on maybe what sounds to make sense and say, where did I learn that from? Where did I hear that was good from? Yeah. Was it out of God? Was it from God's mouth or was it from somewhere else? And the idea that, and to answer any objection, the idea that there's a template, there's a pattern to life. Yes, you can deviate from it. Jordan said that earlier. Yes, you can deviate, but it needs to be intentional. It needs to be sober-minded. It needs to be for a purpose. I think a parallel would be a life of singleness. You know, you shouldn't really, probably you shouldn't be preparing as a child to be single. You should be preparing to be a husband, a wife, a mother, a father. And if you're called into singleness, that is a deviation from the norm, but it can be very godly. That's the first point. Second point is that I found it fascinating that this popped up on my feed and it was almost exactly what we said. And it's not coming from a Christian source. It's coming from someone who just experienced it in their own life and has moved back to their hometown. And I think he bought like 60 acres and he's got chickens and, you know, he works a normal job. He's not a millionaire yet by the internet, I guess. And I guess I can end the point there. This is coming from experience. It's coming from people at the end of their life think this way, and God agrees.
So what you're saying is God is way ahead of us. There are many such cases. Yeah.
You climb the mountain of philosophy. You never heard that picture and you end up on the top and it turns out the theology was right all along.
Yeah.
You know, it's at the top waiting for you.
Yep.
Yeah. So just a couple structural, even economic pictures that I've found helpful because you need to set trajectories early on. I'm going to share a couple websites. So I went to a conference, a men's conference at C.R. Wiley's church a year or two ago. And both these guys, Nathan Spearing was there. This is spearing.co. And then this guy, Rory Groves. And they both spoke about this idea of family-centered economies that has stood the test of time. So he goes through all these different businesses and which ones can involve your family, create freedom, and create an inheritance, not just of money, but of work and livelihood that you can pass on to your kids. And then Nathan Spearing has this really powerful testimony where the dude was a special operator and like full-time deployed with the military and was set to get his
retirement stuff.
Yeah, essentially his retirement from the military where they're just gonna
pension.
Yeah, exactly. That's the word. There it is. I was actually at that conference. So he's just waiting for his pension. He has another 5 years to go. And all of the logic was, hey, just wait things out, get your pension, and then you have passive income. And of course, yeah, you're set. Then spend your time with your kids. Well, it's 20 years to get to that. And he's like, forget that. I'm not going to give up this 5 years of my life with the kids where he's being deployed off and on throughout the year. So he quits 5 years before pension and he starts a business from scratch. And within 5 years, has more passive income from his business and way more freedom, way more flexibility. And he was with his kids than he would have had from his military pension.
What's up?
And so my one thought is, and I wrestle with this because I'm an entrepreneurial at heart, but I've served in ministry. And so that could be harder to involve your kids in,
right?
As like a family business. So I do struggle with this and I'm wrestling through even this summer, how to help my two daughters start one starting a babysitting business and the other one starting a swim lesson, business to help earn some money. And so, but all that to say, structuring your life,
yeah,
even if it means, and this other guy, Groves, he quit like a high paying, programming job where he said he was on track to be a chief technology officer at a Fortune 500 company. And he stepped out of that because he couldn't involve his kids in his coding, right? Yeah. he goes around into a dark room and codes and he can't involve his kids necessarily in that. And so being able to start something that involved everyone made all the difference, even if it meant giving up the 6- and 7-figure job.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. I got an anecdote, guys, that's powerful, and it's challenging me a week-by-week basis. So I right now have a work trader. In Hawaii, this is very common, but you can probably find it a lot of places. And I'm letting him stay in my place in exchange for helping me. And he was an engineer, and I haven't dug into his story fully yet. Not a Christian at this point, but I think has a background. So he was an engineer. I think he was making good money. He was in all those kinds of companies, big companies. And to right now, he's got... When he shows up to come to my house and help me build a cabin, he's got one express van. That's not an express van. It's a Ford Transit. He's got a Transit with the whole family in it. They all come at one time. And while he's building the cabin, his two oldest boys are helping him. And the wife is there with all the young ones, and they're building rock walls in my backyard. And they're just a lovely family. And you can tell some of these principles. Again, this is an interesting intersection. Not coming from a, maybe there's an underlying biblical view, but not coming from an expressly biblical view.
Yeah.
Someone who just said, I'm dropping it all. His kids climb coconut trees, which I actually don't advise, but his kids climb coconut trees and use tools and use machetes. And I do advise that, but not the trees part. And I mean, it's real. You can really do it. You know, and obviously that person made a big, and he started a company with health products and stuff, but people are really doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you guys see the guy who quit his job, sold everything and bought a sailboat and is sailing across sailing from the West Coast of the United States, I think, from the West Coast.
Tattoo, yeah.
Yeah, all the way to Hawaii. He's going out to see, you know, see people who we love. Yeah, man, lots of good stuff.
Okay, hey, Ryan, how does Bitcoin relate to all of this? Let's share your tweet and teaching your kids.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Boom.
I mean, this was from a couple of years ago. It was I think it was the day that Cash App first launched the ability for... So Cash App has children custodial accounts, so it's connected to, you know, adult accounts or parent accounts, basically. But it was really cool because it allows the kids to purchase the Bitcoin themselves right inside the app, which has been awesome. I actually just pulled my daughter in right before we started just to see how she's done. And she's been buying like very consistently over the past year. She's up 45%, which is a substantial amount in fiat wise. And yeah, I mean, probably I would say the best way to orange pill your kids and teach them about Bitcoin and teach them about the value of having a low time preference and saving more than, you know, as much as possible is being around them. So like all my kids are Bitcoiners, but it's just a, it's more, the biggest thing is it's a function of how much time we've spent together, and they're the easiest ones to talk about Bitcoin to. I have this constant audience. they're always up for talking about it. A quick side note, I had a meeting with a guy earlier this year, and like his family can't stand him talking about Bitcoin. And so like we literally met up and we went and met up for beers just because he hadn't had anyone to talk to about Bitcoin. We're still so early that there's random Bitcoiners out there that like, or their kids are too old and they just think, you know, if you don't talk about Bitcoin until your kids are old, they might laugh at you and like, because they don't get it quick enough. And like, that's literally the case. Anyways.
What was that thing where your youngest daughter like found a penny or a coin and she's like, look, Dad, a Bitcoin.
Yeah. Everything was a Bitcoin at first. And then I got the little the Bitcoin stamp, you know, that you can like engrave. Yeah, so I stamp what these is, with the little big, it's the little Bitcoin logo.
Now, quick question on the Cash App. So are these accounts under your account? So you have the smartphone and their child accounts within your Cash App that you can transfer Bitcoin to the child's account? Or do they have their own phones?
Yeah, they have their own phone, their own, like they log in and yeah, it's their own Cash App account. It's connected to my account. So like technically, I think I have control over it until they're 18. As soon as they turn 18, it just transfers into their name automatically. Mm-hmm. It also has some safeguards, like they can't like panic sell, like if it drops and they... I actually don't even think it lets them sell. So it's like...
It's insured by mom and dad. Yeah,
they can only buy, and they have to wait until they're 18 to sell.
Bitcoin is a one-way door, children. Let's get.
It's like the greatest gift ever. Like, anyways.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Ash. How do you guys teach your kids about money? How do you do allowance or payments for chores? How are they earning Bitcoin as young kids or teenagers?
Our kids have a grandmother who pays them way too much. Like our kids literally get paid like $20 an hour to mow the lawn. Like it's in, like not our lawn, but like my mother-in-law's lawn. And then they just bring me cash and just tell me, I just had my daughter do it. She walks in here and hands me, she's like, hey Dad, I have $246. Can I buy Bitcoin? I was like, yes, you can. So then I just buy it. I had no idea about the Cash App thing. So I'll have to Google that link. Just smash bought with River, tgfb.com/river. Go over and you can support us there. But I need to talk to Alex, see if we can get them to put in a similar feature.
I'll just say I had my last night about 9:00 p.m. We were coming back from a homeschool co-op thing, and shout out to this podcast. My 13-year-old said, Dad, on the drive home, can we listen to your podcast? And now my 9-year-old was in the back crying, you know, it's just people talking. But I don't negotiate with terrorists, so it turned into, we listened to about like 3 minutes or 5 minutes of the podcast, and then the kids were all like, well, what is Bitcoin, Dad? And by the time we arrived home, all the kids said, can we put all of my money in Bitcoin? And then in the morning they said, Dad, could we sell the house and my business and everything and just buy Bitcoin? And said, will you guys live in a tent with me on the land, you know?
They sound like little Michael Saylors.
Yeah. And here, you know, you can do it here in Hawaii. It's easier than some other places, but I didn't get into how the bathrooms would work and stuff, but there's an answer for that. But now, hey, to be fair, they're trusting Dad, and that's not good enough. They need to go farther and say, hey, I trust Dad. But that's really encouraged me to want to start putting this stuff into a format that kids understand, you know? And to give an example of inflation, I told him, if Daddy had his cup of coffee in the morning and then you drank half of it and then filled the other half with water and said, don't worry, Daddy, I drank half of it, but you still have a full cup of coffee, would I be happy?
and they said no, and they understood inflation. So I would love to see tools, or if there aren't any, consider for myself, how am I going to truly educate them? Because I think it is understandable, and I'm going to attempt a connection here. It's understandable in the same way that the earlier topic we made of living in your home, having grandkids at home, being near your parents, starting business with your family. This is not hard for kids to understand. It's us that have been brainwashed, right?
Yep.
So as I explain it to kids, and as they see, you know, families like Ryan's and with his boys going to business with him, as they see it, it makes perfect sense. And I tell them all the time, if there's anything I can ever do to help you get in a home, to help you have a business, I'll do it, and to the best of my ability. And I hope you'll live nearby. And recently on her own, my 13-year-old, who has felt like she doesn't want to live in Hawaii, has started to come around and be like, I want to live near you guys, you know, when I grow up. So wrapping the point up, the point is kids can understand it very easily.
Mm-hmm.
I do think an underappreciated aspect of this is wealth. And we just never had these conversations. And again, like people are in different situations in terms of like their generational trajectory and generational history, right? Like, so my dad was a first generation Christian. My mom was a barely second generation Christian. And again, they grew up on a farm. So like there was some awareness of this and some, you know, thinking about this, but I mean, my parents grew up working for a Christian nonprofit organization. And so we just never had a ton of money. So the idea of, hey, I'm going to give you a hand with this, was not really something that was able to happen. And I don't begrudge them, you know, for that at all. But like there are, when you do have wealth, it does open up the opportunity to be able to do some of these kind of things. And so I think that, I mean, just Bitcoin in terms of the opportunity, I mean, just the compounding opportunity that Bitcoin offers is so powerful. And just being able to do this at some point, you know, like if you're listening to this and you have no kids, like I can't recommend it enough. If you're doing this, you already have kids. Like I look at this and I'm like, man, Lord, I wish I would have known about Bitcoin and bought Bitcoin like 4 years earlier. I could have already been, you know, implementing, you know, some of these things could be farther along in some of these things. But I think just like, you know, wherever you're at, having these conversations and starting to think through them, is just something that, you know, can benefit both your kids and yourself and your future, you know, future generations.
I feel like you just made a perfect segue, Jordan, into one of our other topics we wanted to talk about that Brian Norgaard posted recently.
I can share that. 1 second. Here you go. And tell us who this guy is, Matt.
So Norgaard, Ryan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you know better. I think he was one of the top first founders of Tinder, but he's also been involved in a lot of other, he has his own fund and everything like that. And I got to know him just a little bit on an app I was playing around with last year. And so I've been following him for a bit. And this almost seems like a divine moment too, right after we were talking, you know, right during the things we're talking about in this pod. Norgaard, who does not come from a Christian background, here's what he says. Few of my tech friends discuss family. Among my Bitcoin friends, it's often the starting point. And my response was tons of Christian Bitcoiners as well. And by the way, that's no accident. In terms of maybe that may be why some of the some of the Bitcoin friends are always talking about it. And I've posted, it caused me to remember or to consider it, and trying to look on my own post. But I more or less said a couple posts to the extent that, if AI is more in the tech side of that, and Bitcoin is more in the, Bitcoin is definitely tech, but Bitcoin is on that family side of things. Maybe one frame to look at it is Bitcoin is for legacy. And who's thinking about legacy? Mostly people with families. And so my kind of, you know, first thoughts on that is AI is lucrative. Bitcoin is legacy.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the culture of Silicon Valley and the tech industry is anti-family, it's anti-child, and there's such a high time preference of just in the moment consumption. What's the next tech breakthrough? Fast money, fast cars, like that whole world. And it's a reason, like there's reasons that Silicon Valley missed Bitcoin. Like the vast majority of them, they all knew about it from 2011. They were checking Hacker News. They were on the chat forums. Like they knew about the technology and then scoffed at it, yeah. Right? Because they're so close to the money printer. They have the venture capital money. You got the PayPal mafia. You have all this already like established flow of money and idea of what does innovation look like and what does a 100x look like on your capital investment. And Bitcoin broke all those laws and all those rules and had an ancient, you could say, philosophy behind it and a future oriented like 200 year on-ramping process of the mining of the blocks. And like it is designed for legacy, and Silicon Valley lost it. And that's why the tech bros are a bunch of like gay childless men, and like Bitcoiners tend to get like TradFi wives and say, let's have kids.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was, well, Y Combinator invested in Coinbase. And so again, another example, they shouldn't have had an excuse to miss it. But then, like, I think Paul Graham was a classic example. I can't remember. I want to say it was in 2023 when he tweeted, you know, some like that he had some alpha that, you know, it was either something about Ethereum or just a bad take on Bitcoin again. But ultimately, I think Bitcoin's a humility test, and Bitcoin didn't need the VC community. It didn't need Silicon Valley at all. And there was no value add in that. Like, yeah. So that's where it's like a humility test in the sense that, like, yeah, I mean, it's a great thing for them. They could have just purchased some, but there was nothing that they could do. And so they were trying to be too clever. What is it? Greg Foss's thing. They were trying to be too clever by a half or whatever it was. But then in the end, there was nothing for them to add. And so they missed it, which is kind of, it's just kind of wild, right? All they had to do was just be humble and, you're muted, Jordan.
Keep going. You're good.
No, did I see you say stay humble and stack sats?
No. I said the spiritual parallels are insane. Like, when you think about, I mean, again, you think about just the Jewish religious leaders, right? Like, they have the scriptures. It lays out, like, this is what you should be looking for. There's all these things. And then the guy comes. He's doing all of these things. He's, like, fulfilling all these things. He's right there in front of them. They know the scripture. They've literally memorized the entire Old Testament. And yet, because of these extra factors, you know, it was, he didn't come the way that they expected. He wasn't, you know, outwardly impressive looking. He wasn't coming over and they basically, you know, telling them what a great job they were doing. Like, it wasn't flattering to them. And because of that, they rejected him. Like, it was going to cost them glory. There was no way for them to get glory from him until they rejected him. And then you have these people who weren't looking. This is Paul's whole argument in Romans 11, is like the people who weren't looking for him are the ones who found him. And so, like, you have these people who are just not professional investors. We know none of us are like there's not many wise, not many powerful. It wasn't all these amazingly strong, smart people who found Bitcoin. Like, it's a bunch of these guys. You have, like, and again, I'm not trying to attack him, but Mandrick, you know, he's literally this dude's, he's like, you know, cleaning toilets to get Bitcoin. He has no pedigree. Yeah, exactly. He's selling baklava to accumulate Bitcoin. And now he's worth more than, like, you know, his percentage gains relative to a lot of these investors. He's like basically Warren Buffett on crack. And so shout to Mandrick. Mandrick is a credit. It's not a friend, but
I'm looking forward to that at the Bitcoin conference. Is getting some chocolate baklava.
Yeah,
I'm gonna hunt you down.
We call it Choco Baklava, aka Baklava Cash. It's the fork off of real time tested baklava. But
and by the way, I went out to Silicon Valley last fall or maybe last summer. It was right before our sixth was born, and I got to meet Naval Ravikant and some other guys that were in doing a meetup, and the vibe that is there and in most tech things is if you took everybody there who's doing stuff for the world. Now, let me just say, as a Christian, yes, it does matter that we're pushing things forward. More energy, more technology, more security, all these things really matter. So that's the beating heart of kind of these tech centers. And so Christians shouldn't say, no, you should all just be on farms, not contributing these things to the world. But having said that, if you took out the people that are looking for an exit to get their money primarily, and not primarily passionate about the moving forward of humankind, and then you took out the people who are kind of like, they're always selling, they're selling their next thing, you know, my app answers that question, you know, so on and so forth. If you took out all of that, how many would be left? 10%? 5%? So in speaking about humility, the opposite of that is saying, we're going to make humankind this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do, from a humanistic point of view, we're going to overcome death. That's that one guy's, you know, what's that dude?
Brian Johnson.
Yeah, we're going to overcome death, and there's going to be, we should be living eternally, and all this kind of stuff really is part of the beating heart of tech. And then there's also amazing contributions. But if you take out the vanity from it, how much is left of people who are just there literally serving humanity?
Yeah, so I think that's a good segue. So we have a philosophy major on this call. I don't know if you guys know that, but he tends to get, a little stuck in the details of the weeds of philosophical ramblings.
Good Lord, so, what are we talking about here?
Professor Bush, about what is social contract theory and why are we going to talk about it on this podcast?
Yeah, so I mean, this comes up a lot. So first of all, if you guys aren't following Pastor Rich Lusk, what are you even doing with your life? Okay, go follow this guy. Basically, everything he tweets is just pure flames. So he's a pastor up in Birmingham, Alabama, Presbyterian guy. He's the absolute man. So basically, social contract theory. Is basically just the idea of like, what is it that binds humanity together? Like, what is it that, you know, why should humanity care about each other? What are the things that, you know, motivate them to care about each other or whatever? And so this is basically a tweet that he wrote about that. So a note on social contract theory. Social contract theory, originating primarily with Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, is not only contrary to a biblical theology of the state, but also tells a story that is so patently absurd, it's hard to believe it ever gained credence in the first place. Social contractualists, in brief, assume that men by nature are isolated individuals existing in a state of war with one another. They then voluntarily enter into a social compact with each other, establishing the, quote, state, end quote. They consent to give up some of their individual liberties to enter into common life. So society follows the individual and is the product of individual decisions. Biblically, however, the hostility that exists between men is not quote-unquote natural at all. Rather, it comes in as a result of the fall. Moreover, in sin, more to the point. Moreover, the story as told by social contract theory makes human community peripheral to human life, as though we were by nature isolated atoms. They claim that the individual precedes the social. It would be hard to imagine anything more obviously false. Human beings, from the very point of conception onwards, already existed community. Community is not something added to human life as a tacked-on, optional extra. It is constitutive of human life. As John Zazoulas has so aptly put it, being is communion. That is, to be in communion. God exists only in community as Father, Son, and Spirit, a unity in Trinity. Mankind has made the communal image of God. The inescapability of community is seen, furthermore, as we ask how these isolated individuals could enter into social compact with one another unless they already shared a common socialization, so that they spoke the same language, employed the same customs or rituals, and so forth. In short, the theories of Hobbes and Locke, so integral to modern Western democracies, simply don't square with the way the world actually works. They require us to go against the grain of human life. Since the creation of Adam, the only man ever to exist in isolation from other humans, and even then only temporarily, society always has at least temporal priority over the individual. There are certain givens in human life that are simply not a matter of individual consent. The stories Hobbes and Locke tell as the mythical foundations of their theories are nonsense. Okay. Obviously, that was long, but this is just so good, man. This is so, so right on. This whole thing, like, it makes so much sense. Like, what Hobbes and Locke are saying, it sounds so great until you just remember this basic fact that, again, you, like, so much of what it means to be human is outside of your control. I think we mentioned this at the end of the last episode. So much of every single one of the most important decisions or the most important things in your life, you had no part in choosing. Okay, you did not choose when to be born, where to be born, to whom to be born. You don't choose to keep your heart beating. You don't choose to keep your brain working. You don't choose to keep your lungs working. All of these things, they're totally outside of your volition. And so what that ought to do is to drive you to just, you know, listen to the screaming testimony of all of these things that are telling you this life is not about you as an individual. Like, this is so important and so true, especially in a world that is so saturated with Locke and Hobbes. We live in a culture that is just inundated to the point that we don't even think to question these ideas. And so, and again, I would argue that a big part of the reason why we're at a point that it's so difficult for us to even conceptualize and even think about how obviously false this is because there's so much incentive, both from a governmental level, from a philosophical level, to basically to diminish questions about reality and questions about what life actually is. And basically anything that would remind us of the reality that God actually exists. Like, there's so much incentive for governments to suppress that question so that you don't question their authority. There's so much, so much incentive for banks and other people who benefit from, you know, exercising power over people for people to not think about and question, these realities that are presented to us, because then we could question them and they could lose market share and could lose money and could lose all kinds of other control and power that they maintain over individuals and people. But I just was super grateful for Rich Lusk, mentioning that and just, laying all that out. So thank you, Pastor Lusk.
So the super deep, taking it down to like a really practical example that struck home for me is social contract theory essentially creates a transactional relationship with people that says, if you don't fulfill your side of the contract, then I can break my side.
Correct.
And so I have this distinct memory. Oh, I have a little person. I'm on a... You go back out. I had a message. I'm supposed to take the kids to the Lego store. They entered some Legos into a contest and they get to see if they won.
Let's go.
Okay, back to the show. So I have this distinct memory from like the race riots and protests of like 2021, probably. It all blurs together. But there was a scene where there was this group of rioters and they were burning down the CNN headquarters. And it was this like moment of irony where they're like, wait, we're the good guys, aren't we? And they're like, no, you're not. And one of the protesters / rioters, where they were being interviewed, and they said, they broke the social contract, right? And essentially saying, you've done these things, you've lied to us, you haven't done your side of the bargain, and so therefore we get to burn down your building. And like, that's the concept of it creates a tit for tat. I will only be a good citizen if you do what you think or what I think you ought to do for me. as opposed to saying God establishes the state with its purposes and he gives us our responsibilities as children of God and as citizens, and we're under that authority and we don't get to buck against it because it's not man, it's God.
Yeah, that's great, dude. That's a great, very practical example. Well done.
Yeah, this may not be exactly at the center of this point, but in a situation like that and many other things we're experiencing now, failure of the magistrate to enforce the laws leads to a far greater problem as well, because there's this idea, not only idea, reality, that there will be no consequences. And in some cases, there will be positive consequences. And I'm thinking about a lot of stuff. People are looking back at the 2008 financial crisis. And how did this all happen? Well, part of it is every bad actor from the smallest to the largest basically had no consequences for their actions, you know? And of course, the people who have the biggest responsibility are at the top. But I had a friend who was one of the broke, you know, he made like an all right salary and he had the opportunity to lie on his application and get a $500,000 condo. And, you know, hey, I'm going to try to renovate it. And next year it'll be worth 600. And if I renovate, it'll be worth 750. And he eventually defaulted on it. So it happened at the bottom too. What's the consequences? Zero. And if you're at the top, actually the consequences are you're rewarded. The government gives you money and you walk out with millions of dollars in bonuses. So I don't mean to bring that to a whole new topic, but the point is, when the social contract has been broken and when the magistrate doesn't do their job, it creates a lot more, maybe it strengthens that position where we're going to take it into our own hands.
Yep. All right.
Who's next up? One?
We got, yeah. Is this last? We got two more.
No. I can do mine. And I think we have some funny ones.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Okay. So this is going to talk, this is the, like Piper Cub 20 years later conversation. How are we doing with John Piper now? So
Piper Cub?
Yeah. That, I don't know. You ever heard that term of like, the Bible college student that all he does is, repeats what John Piper says.
Oh, and, no, I never heard that.
Yeah. Piper Cub.
Okay.
It's a thing. It's kind of like a Cade Stage Calvinist. It actually comes right after the Cade Stage.
Got it.
So this is a post from William Wolfe, and he says, "I've been blessed by John Piper's sermons and books. The Lord has clearly used him to spread the gospel and save souls. I pray he finishes strong." So I can 100% vibe with that and go with that. So, but goodness gracious, these thoughts by Piper after Obama's election are so bad, cringeworthy, and fundamentally unbiblical. And when compared to what he's said about Trump, deeply hypocritical. The political theology of the young, restless, and reform movement and their leaders was terrible. It was essentially secular liberalism, politically speaking, plus civil rights activism, sprinkled with pro-life and flavored with a few Bible verses. Mm. So, and then he's including this quote, and you can read this. I won't go into it. This is from an article from Desiring God that John Piper wrote. And I remember this. He talked about sitting with Al Mohler and watching the inauguration of Obama and describing how he cried three times that day and the joy of seeing how far we had come from a nation that had chattel slavery from Africa, and now here is an African American serving as president. And I can tell you, I listened to a lot of Piper's Martin Luther King Jr. Day sermons. In fact, I've probably listened to all of them. I've read his book on race, and I've deeply appreciated it. I find it biblical. I find it balanced. I don't, like, he was talking about race before it was cool. Like, before there was this huge growth wokeism in the worst kind of way within the evangelical church, as well as just kind of open, like, eyes opening to, hey, this is an issue. And definitely gets blown out of proportion in certain circles and contexts, but in other places it gets totally ignored and pretended like it doesn't exist. So I think there's been good movements in that direction. I think Piper was early on in the conversation. So I don't want to quite throw him under the bus like William Wolf is, but
I don't think like this is William. William's a friend, okay. This is William at very winsome. Okay, this is Winsome Wolf right here. Okay, so I want to acknowledge Winsome Wolf is not. I don't think he is trying to throw. Listen, Winsome Wolf's unwinsomeness is a lot stronger than this. So I think he's trying to both be faithful and you know honor his elders,
yes,
while also being you know truthful. So continue.
Yeah. So this summary, the essential secular liberalism, I feel like his theology of race and the atonement is richer than this. But the political hypocrisy, I feel like that nails it, because look at this. Yeah. So here is Piper in 2024. Presidential election results. Having delivered us from one evil, God now tests us with another. The Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. And I remember his article after Trump was, it was during the 2020 election. He made a point essentially arguing, this is when it was, it blurs together. I think it was the second, the first re-election of Trump. But it was essentially arguing, hey, pro-choice may not be worse than violent rhetoric. And Trump represents this violent rhetoric the disunity that it'll create in our culture versus the Democrat candidate that would promote abortion
and all these things, right? Little pieces.
And here's Justin Dean, who I've known for years, going back to my Acts 29 days. He just says, God has shown us great mercy and shield us from the tyranny and evil that would have come with a Harris presidency and the years of liberal rule to follow it. Rejoice in that. So here he is weeping over Obama getting into office. And all he sees here is the evil that will come from Trump. And it's just like, really? And it smells a lot like the Russ Moore gaslighting that I've seen over the recent years. It smells like homeboy. You guys will know who this is, where he's like, never Trump, this time Harris, always Jesus.
Gross.
Who was that? Why am I going blank?
Ray Orland.
Ray Orland.
Oh, yeah.
Oof.
He posted that on Threads, and it's just like, really?
Then probably deleted
brother?
It.
Yeah, no, he did delete it. And then, yeah, but it's like, help, like, make it make sense to me. Okay? Really. So, I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts? This is, yeah, just kind of processing through the political theology of our evangelical heroes.
Yeah. Go ahead. Jordan. Go ahead. No, go for it, Matt. You're good.
You know, I pastor a small church. I guess it's an average church. Most churches in the U.S. are like, I can't remember if it's 50 to 70 people. And I also don't want to take up a lot of airspace, but agree with everything and share the same experience of Piper. He's hugely built my faith, especially years ago when I was really learning theology. And the thing that comes to my mind, and I just have to wonder, you know, when it comes to Ray Ortland, when it comes to, I think that Russ has kind of gone all the way. He's taken the bus to the final stop, you know. You know, you can get off the bus at certain points, but I think he took it all the way.
Where was he sitting on the bus? I'm just saying, you know. Does it, yeah, just kidding. Go
on. Probably the back, actually. But
That's identifying with,
yeah. Yeah, but I just have to wonder, are these guys evangelizing and discipling people who are first coming to understand about the Lord?
Hmm.
And that, what I mean is this kind of an ivory tower problem where you're surrounded by people who are already theologians, they've already been in the faith a long time, and you're just trying to make sure, you know, what Piper said about a new evil. I can understand what he means outside of the context. I can understand what he means to say, hey, it's not like everything's going to go well now. Now we're going to have these other voices that we shouldn't be hearing either on an extreme. Now we're going to see what I'm seeing a lot of is people joining the Catholic Church and Orthodoxy. And in my view, part of that is a severe misunderstanding about the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of this world, and how we feel powerful. And so we want to join with this movement that is connected in with these institutions and stuff like that. So there's problems with the changing over. And I just have to say, this kind of conversation, I don't find it in helping people come to understand who the Lord is foundationally. It doesn't even really connect, in my view. And I wonder, and I'm not accusing them of not being pastors. I'm not saying, you know, we all know there's issues, which there's another one if we get to it today about someone who is a part of a big ministry and they're doing books and they're doing, you know, careful for ourselves. They're doing podcasts and they're doing the circuit, you know, and you sort of get disconnected and you end up in this world. And I guess I just wonder if they're just... Because whenever I'm preaching and trying to explain to people, I'm very aware, how is this teaching of Jesus or this teaching from God's word distinct from the world? I'm always looking for that, because we have to unlearn what we have learned, as Yoda said. And we have to go, it's not just I'm trying to pile information on top of you.
Yep.
I'm trying to help you understand the kingdom of God is not of this world, what Jesus taught and the rest of the Bible. And you need to replace the things you believe that are lies with the truth. And so does that ring with you guys at all?
Yeah.
It seems like an ivory tower thing.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, with both Piper and Russell Moore, and I'm not sure about Orland. I don't know too much about his life and ministry.
Russ Moore goes to Orland's church.
Okay.
I've been to that church. Was there for a Sunday?
It seems to me that, you know, Jesus talked about it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich person to get into the kingdom of God. I think there's a component of that with fame and power, that it's like, I mean, to put bluntly, avoid it at all. Like, if you could possibly avoid it. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, what people don't understand is the bigger your church, the bigger your ministry, the bigger your audience, the more constant temptations you're going to be deluged with at all times to appease the masses of, like, people that are following you. And so you just see this drift, it looks like a drift left to appease the, you know, the broader culture, as you know, that has grown in those men's lives. And I say it with, like, caution for all of us. Just, it would literally be better to, like, shut something down and walk away from it than if you start, because man, it's strong, right? I mean, going through COVID was brutal. Man, you were literally nonstop. There was, like, lines in the sand. So which one are you? Like, which side are you on? It was like literally every day there's a new line. You had to pick a camp that you were going to placate, basically. And it's like, dude, it's a hard, hard, challenging position to be in. And most people can't handle it. Like, it's...
Mm-hmm. I think one other element of this is one of the things you see is just how your past influences you and, like, the things that are important to you, right? Because, like, Piper talks about how he was racist, like, growing up. He grew up in South Carolina and was, like, horribly racist at, like, you know, given points.
Where Moeller's there too.
Sure. And so, like, that was this deeply formational, deeply formative, affecting period of their lives. And, you know, and so, like, that affects you. And can lead you to, you know, it can make you more sensitive to things than maybe you ought to be. And so it can make you want to overcompensate for this, you know, kind of where you were at. And so again, I'm sympathetic to that reality. Like, that's something we all have to deal with. But yeah, like we all know those people who, you know, there's a comedian named Michael Jr. who talks about it. He's like a Christian guy, and he talks about it. He's like, have you ever met anybody who was oversaved? Where it's like, they literally, like, anytime something comes in, like, they just try to kind of do is cut you off. Like, they can't, there's no rejoicing. It's all just straight, you know, we always have to kind of hem you in and be, yeah, but you have to think about this, you know, like, you have to be afraid of this or whatever. And like, obviously, you know, there are people who are just, Trump can do no wrong. He's Jesus 2.0. But like, that is just not the majority of John Piper's audience.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not a realistic thing. And so, yeah, I just think it comes across. And again, I appreciate having the, you know, William, like, pointing out the difference between them. You know, the, like, just basically you can highlight this. And I think, again, Piper is one of these people where I think he would, I feel like he would appreciate this. Like, I would feel like he would appreciate like a look into, you know, a look at himself, you know, from somebody else's perspective over the course of a few years. I feel like, you know, being able to see this kind of inconsistency, I feel like he'd be like one of the first people to, you know, to appreciate that and be willing to change. Again, just to have a lot of respect for him in a bunch of ways, provided we're not talking about protecting our wives.
You know, what's No Quarter November, Doug Wilson's thing is No Quarter November.
Yeah.
And I think one of the premises behind No Quarter November, which I think everyone, believer and non-believer, should understand about arguments, is you don't have to make every argument when you're making an argument.
Oh, okay. Gosh. And, preach it.
Okay, so I got a couple of theology books back here. And if you remove caveats from
Next and Machete,
how big is it? Yeah. Appropriately next to the machete.
Yeah.
And so whether you agree with Douglas or not, you know, I hope that the future looks like more books that are just making a dang point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Can you just unpack what No Quarter November is?
Well,
Douglas
in November will do, like, he calls it No Quarter. And essentially he means he's going to say some stuff that's probably heavy duty culturally.
Yeah.
And he always lights something on fire and then almost catches on fire himself every time. He like pours gas in a field and then lights it on fire while he's sitting on a couch that's on fire. And that may be over the top. You can question that, but he's making a point. And I'm not even talking about what Doug is talking about. I'm talking about the point that, and let me bring it home. Jesus didn't talk that way.
Yes.
Jesus didn't talk that way.
Correct.
Neither did Moses. Neither did the prophets.
Correct.
Neither did any, the whole Bible is not a caveat loving.
Correct.
So if God is the best pedagogue, let's learn from him and make points, and they don't always have to be balanced, and they don't always have to contain. And we just want to make sure that such and such.
Well,
and a lot of people that such and such.
And let's give one example just to clarify, because again, it's one thing to say Jesus isn't careful when he talks. Like, obviously that's not true. Like, Jesus is very careful, but it doesn't sound careful. There's things that Jesus says where you're like, what in the world are you talking about? And my favorite example of this is Jesus looks at a crowd of thousands of people. Okay, who are there asking him questions. And Jesus says to them, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't be my disciple. You have no part with me.
Mic drop.
100%. Because like, imagine like no pastor today would walk out to the crowd on a Sunday morning and say something like that. Because you'd be like, man, your people are going to misunderstand what you mean. Like, this is so unhelpful. So, you know, like, this is not helpful, whatever. And again, you could make all those same accusations against Jesus. What is he doing? Why is he being so unclear? No, he actually means this. Yeah, sure. Yes, he did mean something else, but he didn't clarify. He literally, it was this sifting thing where Jesus's point was to basically see which one of you, the moment I say something that is difficult to understand, am I valuable enough for you to sit around, to wait around and ask me a question? Or is this so offensive to you that you don't want to be part of me? You don't want to be associated with me, who's willing to say controversial things in ways that seem totally unhinged. Are you going to be offended by me? You know, and Jesus says this multiple times, blessed is he who is not offended by me. And so I think this is such a good example of, Doug is a great example of this, where he's willing to do this in practice, even when it means that people are going to be upset with him for not, you know, you know, crossing every T, dotting every I, making sure you say this in the perfect way so that left-leaning people are not offended by him. Because really, at the end of the day, that's what a lot of this comes down to, is we're scared of, you know, we coddle left and punch right.
So
it's like the god of that we worship in the United States of being, that we have to serve that god of not offending people. And it's a powerful god that
we have. Yeah. Pi though I believe it's on YouTube. Yeah. Yeah. Table kicking Jesus. Very, very similar. Yes.
Awesome. So I'm with you guys 100%, but
all right, Portland, come on, Portland. Here we go.
Hardcore-formed Twitter keyboard warriors who just love offending anyone
that's
who's
true.
Progressive. And that's their full-time like missional calling is being Jesus, kicking over tables and being
correct.
Totally obtuse on Twitter, right?
Yes.
If that you feel like that's your life calling, okay, just a little perspective. No quarter of November is 1 month out of 12.
One out of every 12 of your tweets. 1 month
out of 12. Sure. And he has a serrated edge, actually wrote a book about it, it all that he says. But still, there is room for nuance. I don't know if you guys saw that, the podcast where Doug Wilson came on the Room for Nuance podcast. My pastor, Thomas, is friends with Sean. But it was really like, yeah, Joe Rigney and Doug Wilson. And then this guy, Sean, who does Room for Nuance, and he's interviewing all these big Eva guys. And they even gave him a hard time. They're like, the name of your podcast, if someone said, well, let's be nuanced, automatically you're trying to soften truth. Like, that's what that is.
Yeah.
But if you have no room for nuance, it's all blunt truth that you just hit people with, you also miss I would argue, another part of the character of Christ. And that's the more pastoral side. That's the, like, Matt taking communion to an elderly woman dying of ALS. Like, you don't mean like, you don't see like, oh, you have this, you said this thing out of context, or you have this wrong book on your bookshelf, I need to correct you. Like, no, there's a time for everything under the sun, and there's a time for no quarter, and there's a time for pastoral nuance.
Well, let me answer that, because I feel strongly about this too. I think the point that I want to make, and something, Jordan, you said that points at this too, is, and let me give you an illustration. You go to the gym and you get a trainer, and they start you off on legs. Are you going to say, you're going to go home and be like, babe, this guy doesn't even do arms. This guy doesn't even do any exercise. He doesn't do cardio. He only does legs. No, you're supposed to keep going back to the teacher. Okay.
Yep.
By the way, what percentage of theological controversies does this fix? 85% maybe?
Yeah.
Because you go to Jesus one day and he says, blessed are the poor. They will inherit the kingdom of God. Maybe to your point, Osh, maybe that's like a no quarter pastoral, right? And he's not balancing it with, if you don't take care of your family, you're worse than an unbeliever. He's just saying, oh, that's a lesson for the other day. Keep coming back. You know what I mean? And so Jesus, in his no quarter, eat my flesh, contrary to what some people think, he wasn't trying to teach you transubstantiation.
Amen. Correct. It's cracks.
He was trying to make a point, and you could say in one sense it was no quarter, in another sense it was nuanced, but it was nuanced in the sense that, do you get the point? Okay, if you get the point, let's keep moving on. And what did the disciples say? Where else are we going to go? Who else has the words of eternal life? You know.
Yeah.
So if I
shout out to the first pope. Let's go. Way to go, Peter.
So I want to be like Jesus in my pedagogy and in my discipleship too. And that means that you need to be balanced, but you don't need to be balanced in every moment. You balance out over time. You know what I mean?
That's a fantastic point, dude. Well said.
Yeah.
All right, guys, we appreciate you. This has been, let's see, where are we at? Hour 9. We're good. We got some stuff to do. We got dads to be. I'm taking my kids to go play some sports. So, appreciate you guys, and we will see you on the next episode. I'll let anybody. Does anybody want the last word here? Anybody have anything else they want to drop before we drop?
Ryan's been very meek and mild. Come on, truth bomb.
Truth bomb. I don't know. I don't have anything.
no worries. again, just a reminder, we if you're going to be in Vegas, we're going to be, I think all, actually three of us will be there out in Vegas for the Bitcoin conference. If you're going to be in there, it be in town, we'd love to have you at the TGFB Friends and Family Barbecue. You can grab tickets at, find the pinned tweet on our Twitter account. That's the best way to do it. You can go grab tickets over there. Going to be about 100 people there. It's going to be small. It's going to be good. There's going to be, again, some of your favorite Bitcoin voices, both who are believers and who aren't, are going to be there. So we'd love to have you join us. On top of that, we have, what else is I going to say? Yeah, we're going to be announcing some really cool stuff there. Ben Justman is bringing Bitcoin wine. So you should be coming to take some back for your church's Lord's Supper if you use actual wine. If not, you can just take some home for your wife. It's delicious, delicious organic wine. Come support him. And then beyond that, trying to think, there's something else coming up. What am I thinking?
You're going to Saddleback Church, Jordan.
Oh, that's right. Hey, thank you. That's right. This coming Saturday morning, if you're going to be in the, you know, San Diego, in between, I guess, the Orange County area of California, come out and see me. I'll be there speaking for like an hour, basically, at the church out there. They're doing an AI and Bitcoin event. You can find out more information via our Twitter account. Go find it over there, and you can find out where that's going to be and what time. Appreciate you guys. We'll see you later this week. We're going to be here on Thursday. Oshawa will not be joining us, but we'll have one of the, what do we call them? The ski boys? No, the ski bunnies? Mountain boys. That's it. Yeah, that sounds better. Mountain boys. They'll be with us. We appreciate you guys. We'll see you on the next episode of the To the Unknown pod.
God bless you guys.
See you guys.
Take care.